Hi, this is Paul. There have been so many great videos that have been put out in this corner in the last few weeks. This video with Sam and John was absolutely stellar. Again, and some of the smaller channels lately have been doing just an incredible job of putting out, I think, really thoughtful, quality, provocative stuff that sort of moves the conversation forward. But now, having said that, you could rightly ask, well, what on earth do you mean by putting the conversation forward? Some of these videos, like on Chad's channel or Christian Baxter's channel, these are tiny channels with videos of a few hundred, or maybe even in some cases, just a few dozen watchers. This video on Sam's channel had 2,200 viewers, which the video deserves far more. So I can't cover everything, but this one raises questions about the questions that I just asked. Sam asks really amazing questions about this whole question of AI sages and AI demons. And on the question and answer today, I talked a little bit about demons and spirits and a bunch of different things. But I for a long time, I listened to this as I was landing on an airplane after doing some work in Oregon, Washington State. And I haven't forgotten it. And often it's the videos that sort of stay in my mind that, especially when I have a shortage of time to make videos, sort of rise in the hierarchy here. So let's get into this. Sam asks some incredible questions here of John that I think just at sort of a low resolution way, you can just think of questions and answers. But what's happening is that even just the nature of these questions just provokes us to think beyond sort of our facile, shallow, knee-jerk assumptions. So let's get into it.
Yeah. So another follow-up question is that how connected is wisdom to what sort of being you are?
Yeah.
Is there... is wisdom sort of something that is, I don't know, maybe niche independent, in other words, like could potentially a very wise killer whale be, could a very intelligent killer whale be wise, even though, you know, they live in the sea and eat seals and salmon, and us be wise? And is that the same sort of wise, or is wisdom being a very good version of what you are and what your context-dependent purpose is?
It's just such a terrific question. And so much of what I love about this AI conversation is just like the attempt to create little robots sparked this real the learning that we've done in cognitive science that, oh my goodness, so much more is going on than what we thought was going on. And now with AI, it's causing us to look at ourselves and ask some of these real big questions. Now, one of the questions beneath this, I got into this in the question and answer session a little bit today, is sort of the relationship between an algorithm or a machine. A machine at its simplest thing is sort of a repetition. It's a repetitive pattern. And if I can do this pattern, then an algorithm is sort of a more complex pattern. My wife teaches school, and she teaches Waldorf school, so she goes up with the kids. So she teaches them a broad range of things, and so she talks about teaching them something like long division. And so when you're a kid and you're learning long division, it's like first you learn addition, and then you kind of make those moves, and you have manipulables. And then you're going to have to carry. So you've got sort of one thing, and then you add another thing, sort of an if-then set, and you sort of grow up. Then when you get to long division, it's a little bit more complex, and off you go with it. But for the most part, it's a little process that you have to go through. And if you just follow the steps in the process, you will arrive at the conclusion. Wisdom is trying to get to the best. Now, one of Sam's great missions on his channel is to deal with this question of evolution and teleology, which Sam has really been determined on. And so then the question is, well, where does wisdom come from? How can we have it? And this is even provoking the question, what exactly is wisdom? Can an orca be wise? Can I have a wise dog and an unwise dog, or a foolish dog? Is that really the category that is should be connected with them? And then, of course, we're getting down to these software machines that are getting increasingly complex, and there's machine learning going on. So, and then how then would that wisdom relate to us?
So that's, wow, Sam, these are excellent questions. And part of what I want to do is self-congratulatory. I think one of my goals of the video essay and the essay I've had is to provoke this kind of question being asked, because I think we should be asking these questions in addition to the more technical engineering questions that predominate the social discourse right now. So first of all, thank you. Thank you for that. And I mean, Wittgenstein famously said, even if the lion could speak, we wouldn't understand them because they live in a different salience landscape, for example. And I think we need to, and that's another reason why there can't be a single machine. It's just, we're finding different versions of this same argument over and over again. There's not going to be a sky.
Now, I've got the canine companion dog back now. And so the dog was in prison. There's a program where prisoners train the dogs, and it's a wonderful program. They did a great job, although this gets interesting. So in many ways, when I'm trying to train this animal to be an assistance animal, we're trying to train this dog to deeply relate to human beings. And so the dog goes to prison, and these prisoners who have nothing but time. And I can really understand how this is great for the prisoners and it's great for the dogs, because the prisoners can give intensive time to training the dogs. The dog gets back into our house, and the way our house works and the way our lives work with the dog, when we take the dog to restaurants, and we take the dog to the supermarket, we take the dog to training classes, we take the dog to all these different places. In a sense, we're trying to give the dog some wisdom. Because we want the dog at some point, if you've got a disabled person, to be able to anticipate what the person needs, or at least at best respond to a verbal command by the person in order to do something for the betterment and welfare of the person. And so, but interestingly enough, there's earlier in this video, the whole video is great. You should definitely watch the video. They deal with embodiment because, of course, the dog is embodied in a very similar way to which we are embodied, and humans and dogs have had a very interesting, very productive relationship for a very long time. And we've been co-evolving the dogs, and we could argue that in some more limited way, dogs have helped sort of evolve human civilization. But in watching the dogs, it's amazing how much we can communicate with them and how much they can communicate with us. But what we have, and this is sort of the embodiment issue that they talked about before this, what they have is sort of, we're sort of living in the same place. And the other advantage that we have is we can sort of see the world through the dog's eyes to a limited degree, probably better than the dog can see the world through our eyes.
Skynet, right? That there's too many good arguments against it that don't have good responses. Now, are there general features such that there'll be something general about wisdom that would be across these many different environmental and potentially socio-cultural historical contexts? I think there are. One is, I think it is a general principle that you need something like general intelligence, and then the very same processes that make you adaptively intelligent make you prone to self-deception. Those seem to be like, you know, bias variance trade-off, explore exploit, all the stuff in relevance realization. So I do.
Now John's point there is a great one. But Sam's point is also interesting, because one of the one of the themes and one of these things that I come around a lot to as I, again, as a minister, you're sort of in the business of getting a sense of, now a little bit later, they're going to talk about enlightenment, and that's really important because how we use that word, what on earth we mean by that word. But so as a minister, even though you're not necessarily evaluating the people in your church, you sort of still are, because you have to exercise discernment in terms of who can be a good elder, who can be a good deacon, how can someone handle a task if I give this to them? How will they be with each other? And of course, one of the favorite videos that I made was a video about how often simple Christians, sometimes with lower general intelligence, outperform more sophisticated Christians, Christians who can read complex theology, Christians who have had education, Christians who have climbed certain hierarchies. This is very much within Sam's question, because sometimes someone perhaps with lower general intelligence but has a high degree of experience within a specific limited frame will outperform someone with higher general intelligence but less experience within that specific frame. Now, it might in fact be that the person with higher general intelligence, if they themselves spend that as much time in that specific context, will in time outperform them. But part of what happens in our culture with respect to general intelligence is that we often, by virtue of the hierarchies that attract them and demand their attention, have to play in multiple hierarchies. And again, general intelligence is really helpful for that, because they might be able to get up to speed more quickly in some of the different hierarchies, but they might never master a particular niche like someone even with lower general intelligence, but, and this is where we get into this question of love, someone who loves that niche. And this is where, let's say, if I don't have any children in the home now, but if in fact I were doing this dog training with a homeschooling child that was maybe in middle elementary or older, where I would be busy going to work and doing this and doing that and paying attention to the homeschooling, yada, 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 the homeschooling kid would probably spend 2 or 3 or 4 hours a day getting through their reading, writing, and arithmetic, and maybe reading some good books, and then they would probably spend a lot of time with the dog. And what would happen is that child would likely get to know the dog better than I would. And that child would outperform me, even though I have all of these years of experience, because the child, and this is where care and love become additional features. Now, the question of care and love obviously becomes a huge topic within AI and gets talked about quite a bit in a variety of the AI, conversations that we've had in this little corner. But again, the world is so complex.
I do think that has to be there. And I do think within that, and this is, I think, Plato's profound insight, if any being is both finite and capable of transcendence, which is to care about, love the true, the good, and the beautiful, and they're always trying to properly identify both with them being finite and capable of transcendence, I think that is the sort of hallmark of wisdom, this overcoming of self-deception, this enhancing of religio, so that we are properly respecting and recognizing our place, which is we are finite beings capable of transcendence, but never in a way that transcends us from our finitude. Well, I think there will be aspects, and this goes, of course, with aliens, of the way they think and move, think about Arrival, that will be strange and almost unintelligible to us. It's also the case that I think there will be universals of intelligence, rationality, and wisdom that will mean they're not completely incommensurable to us. And this is, again, to use the analogy, organisms vary considerably across the environments of the Earth, but there are ways of comparing them and classifying because they are all subject to the same principles of evolution, things like that.
Yeah.
And but of course, that point that he just makes touches on, again, back to the embodiment question, that there's a commonality between me and this dog that I'm training that no computer can touch. And the sophistication of an embodied machine, even just saying it, embodied software, it's really huge.
I've often wondered if Wittgenstein was right about that. Somehow I think that we probably could, like, if a lion could talk and we were able to create some sort of shared language or be able to translate, I think there's a lot that we could communicate back and forth with a lion. I mean, it already seems like we're able to communicate with our own dogs pretty well, although that might be self-deception. I don't know. But, you know, we know, like, even dogs get, like, happy or sad or scared or excited or anxious. And there's a huge amount of, I mean, I don't know how much of that is that there's only sort of one way to be embodied, or that mammals, like, you know, we have a lot of shared evolutionary history.
Yep.
And
yep.
So a lot of our neurotransmitters and brain regions are pretty similar. And so there's a lot of similarity going on there. But would an alien dog be similar?
Well, I mean, yeah. And actually, I'm working with a student who's trying to formalize this kind of looking across species. But we can literally have conversations with birds like Alex the parrot, that all the evidence is those are comprehended conversations. They're not parrots or parroting or anything like that, right? And birds have a much different evolutionary history. Like our common ancestors way the heck
way, back. Way, way back, yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think Wittgenstein had a flair for hyperbole, which is often masked by the austerity of his prose. There's a point there. The point is you can't capture all of the pragmatics and the semantics and the syntax. And I think that point, I think there's almost sort of something approximating consensus amongst linguists and philosophers of language that part of the argument.
And that's a huge point, that and of course it's in many ways at the heart of what we've been talking about. You can only get so much embodiment into language. And when you look at the lengths we go to shoehorn more and more in, and we celebrate fine literature because in many ways great literature gets more embodiment word by in a word for word way. And it's part of the reason that film, you have music, you have visual. I mean, we're trying to get as much embodiment in. And then you've got to get embodiment into software and the signals that software can receive. And of course, a lot of Sam's conversations with respect to this have been just absolutely outstanding because of the kind of work Sam does, trying to use these machines to improve, let's say, hospitals or ERs, because it's deeply connected with John's work, the relevance realization. Well, what's relevant to the functioning of an ER? There was a woman in this church, she's passed away a number of years ago now. She was an ER nurse, and she ran one of the it was the county hospital here. She ran that ER as a nurse. She was her relevance realization was sharp. I've told this story before. When I first got to this church, there was one woman would pick songs at the beginning of the service, and then I would pick the songs during the service. And there's a history to that I won't get into. And one day she asks me, and she says, "Pastor, so Nina picks the songs before the service, and you pick the songs during the service? Yeah. I like Nina's songs better." didn't sugarcoat it into any of it. Just there, Pastor. But she had, over years, she picked up wisdom about how to run an ER by experience. And a lot of it would have been sort of this intuitive intuition. She might not have been able to articulate the patterns, but she could recognize them and she could act upon them. And really, that's wisdom.
The argument, like, really holds, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, and I think you're right. And I think that is convergent with the argument I made that if we get the rational, wise orcas, that perhaps there'll be parts that we just can't get. Like, I don't know why dogs have to do this inane, long calculus before they decide where they're going to poo. Like just poo.
I have thought of this so often after John said this. Now, every time I take that dog out. Now, this is a trained dog. When I take this dog out, this dog, generally speaking, will pee and poop on command. And the dog is trained to do it. And we trained a dog to pee and poop on command on any surface because the person that has this dog might be in a wheelchair and that dog's going to have to do their business on command. And so we're really refining this dog to be very much within a human's landscape. But every time I let out that, it drives my wife crazy because my wife is much more of a perfectionist than I am. And I really want the dog to go in this area of the yard and not the rest of the yard. Yeah, honey, I get that. But sometimes it's like rainy or cold outside. I just want to let the dog out there. And what John said right there, again, I have thought of numerous times when I'm standing out there in the cold and the rain and the dog, it's like, what calculations are you doing? Why here and not there?
Right? What, like, you checked that spot 3 times ago. What's changed, right? And but there's something else going on, right? Because they're much more smell-oriented than we are, et cetera, et cetera.
And then I noticed when the dog, my wife wanted over here in this one corner of the yard, but my neighbors got a male yellow lab. And when that yellow lab came, then suddenly she starts wanting to poop and pee over by the fence line shared with the neighbor's dog who's going over there. And I thought, oh, maybe there's something to that. Maybe there's wisdom in operation.
And so there'll be those Wittgensteinian lacuna. But like you said, and I think quite correctly, you know, we seem to be able to interact with them at the level of them being something analogous to somewhere between a 2 and 3 year old human being. We can do amazing things with certain kinds of birds. And with chimps, when we've given them, you know, better abilities to communicate sign language and the lexigrams and So I'm glad you brought that up because I agree with you.
And that's very relevant. That's not just like a curious side path to this conversation. It's very relevant to thinking about what it would be like to try and communicate with an artificial intelligence if it had more capabilities than it does now. Because obviously it wouldn't have any shared biological history with us.
Yeah.
But is there some sort of universal convergence to information, communication, and language that would allow us to hope for some real genuine communication back and forth, even across big differences? And, you know, like a weird example that I would point to, like a couple of years ago, there was that Nobel Prize winning discovery of like building those machines that could detect gravitational waves. And, you know, so like somewhere 2 black holes collide and that sends gravity waves through the universe. I'm not going to pretend to understand that really. But Apparently if you build really sensitive lasers in a cross that are like a couple miles long in rural Louisiana, then the slight perturbations in the laser can detect these gravity waves from across the universe. And Part of me is like, okay, so that seemingly suggests to me that almost any information out there in the universe is plausibly understandable and sensible by us if we are able to build something, basically a sense that's almost like a new sense to be able to detect gravitational waves.
So I've been reading another book, and part of me and my consciousness goes, well, why don't you finish some of the books you started to read? Yeah, but I'm so freaking ADHD that some of these other books look good, and then some things arise, and. So I'm reading this book on the Enlightenment, and I'm finding it fascinating. And I'm finding it fascinating in how many different ways right now in all of these conversations. The nice preface in the book notes that the Enlightenment is very much sort of up for debate now, because you've got the likes of Steven Pinker, who, of course, we've seen on YouTube talking about, oh, the Enlightenment. And then you've got the postmoderns who complain about the Enlightenment on all sorts of ranges, et cetera, et cetera. The Enlightenment declares the conviction that the good life, the goal of life, is happiness, and that if this goal could be attained, it has to be found in the here and now, despite the manifold imperfections of earthly life. Great way to start a book. It's a good book. But what Sam just got me going, just reminded me, is this. So this chapter on Descartes trying to figure out the version of mechanical philosophy that achieved most impact was that of Descartes. Although he is chiefly remembered now as a philosopher, Descartes' philosophy was intended to support his science by providing a basis for absolute certain knowledge. Now, this business of certainty is in and of itself such an interesting aspect, because, again, it has everything to do with faith. It's like, so faith is belief without evidence. I can't think of a stupider attempt to define a word than that. If I examine my ideas rigorously and winnow out all those ideas that might be false, I am left with a small number of clear and distinct ideas, including the idea of God. Since God is completely good, it is impossible. This is Descartes, of course. It is impossible that he should deceive me by making me believe ideas that are in fact false. The small stock of ideas, including abstract concepts of shape, motion, and extension, the property of occupying space, therefore provides the basis for knowledge, and Descartes implies that the knowledge of the world deduced from these basic ideas can be arranged in a quasi-logical sequence, like the propositions of geometry. The knowledge thus obtained, however, does not resemble our everyday empirical knowledge of the material objects. It is knowledge of things as they really are, knowing them as God knows them. Wow. That's bold. The sensory qualities we perceive simply correspond to the effects of bodies in our nerves. The nature of body, now Peugeot has in his membership section a video on body. That's not his YouTube membership section, it's his Patreon membership section. And it was just fascinating to me how after 6 years we're still working on this. And so then you read this and you say, well, after 500 years we're still working on this. All matter is the nature of body consists not in weight, hardness, color, and the like, but simply in extension. All matter is extension. There can therefore be no empty space, no vacuum. The whole of space is filled up by tiny bodies or particles, an idea Descartes developed under the influence of his friend from the Dutch mathematician Isaac Beeckman. This corpuscular theory marks a rejection of Aristotle's assumption that matter consists of four basic elements, earth, air, water, and fire. Beeckman and Descartes suppose instead that the world consists of homogeneous particles, and the difference among phenomena can be explained by the particles' movement. This presents another problem, however. If the world is completely filled with particles, it might follow that the movement of one particle communicates itself to other particles, so that every part of the world is in constant motion. To avoid this consequence, and the perpetual seasickness they would imply, Descartes supposes that matter moves in circles. He calls them vortices. A fish that swishes its tail in a deep pool displaces the water around it, but does not move all the water in the pool. And then Sam gives this idea, and this gives this notion about lasers picking up the gravitational waves of how far away. And it's like, oh, wow. We really don't know what's going on.
There's almost some universality of information and its ability to be comprehended, interacted with, and communicated.
I agree with that. And that goes towards, ultimately, I would like these two conversations to be integrated. We don't have to do that here. But I've been making, and with Greg Enriquez and on my own, I've been making and with you in a couple of conversations, I've been making an argument for a kind of extended naturalism, Neoplatonism, as a way of trying to articulate that kind of thing. What is the ontology of informational intelligibility? I am of the conclusion that what you just said is right, that there are important universals, and those universals are so important, they are instantiated in the way our cognition is organized. I sometimes use a Wittgensteinian metaphor here. The grammar of reality and the grammar of cognition are fundamentally the same in really important ways. There's not only a deep continuity this way, there's a deep continuity this way. And this is, of course, the claim of Neoplatonism. Now, I chose to not explicitly link the argument about the Silicon Sages to that, because I wanted it to be clearly the case that the argument we're discussing here does not depend on a prior commitment to Neoplatonism or any such thing. But if you grant the independent plausibility of the arguments, then there is, I think, a way of integrating them together that would address your question. So it's basically the question, if there are universals, let's say it's plausible that there are universals of rationality and wisdom, perhaps even of enlightenment, as I talked about it, and what do they ground out in universals of the ontology of informational intelligibility that would make sense of the claim that these beings would not be completely incommensurable to us? And Neoplatonism is this grand mixture of this grand, I think, proper ontology, which I think can be made, for which a strong case can be made, and this thought experiment, this really terrific thought experiment about the possibility of intelligences and, right, much greater than ours, and how we might possibly enter into relationship with them, like the debates between the Plotinian Neoplatonists and the followers of Iamblichus. There's a great thought experiment that there are, right, there are the gods, right, in the Neoplatonic sense, and so I think that is something that we could make philosophical progress on, and we could come to some rational hope that we would not get enlightened beings that were completely incommensurable to us, but plausibly would be like the enlightened beings that have perhaps risen within. I am of the conclusion that there have been enlightened people, properly so. I think the historical evidence is as good as for the historical evidence of Julius Caesar or something like that. And what was our relationship with them? Well, there was parts of them that were just incommensurable. Like, what the heck are they talking about? But there was enough that they gave us a way so that we seemed to be able to approach enlightenment so that we could understand what they were talking about in an embodied way. And so, that's a long way of saying, I think your question is a good one. I think we have historical precedent for how we could answer it. I think some of my work could help in that project, and I think this is the relevant question to be asking, because we don't want to make these things and they be incommensurable to us, right? But you pointed out we have been terrifically clever at being able to communicate not only with other organisms but with parts of reality that are terrifically obscure, right? And complex and dynamic and removed from our sensory motor temporospatial scale, And so there you go.
Mm-hmm. Now, part of what really hooked me in this video is, again, using this term enlightenment. And it was after this video that I, in fact, because my bent tends to be historical, that I went back to this question of enlightenment. And because, you know, partly with the whole conversations with Orthodoxy and renewed debate with respect to the Enlightenment and the Protestant Reformation, that it's really important yet difficult to talk about what on earth do we mean by this word. We use the word, and in many ways, John talking about, so let's say, let's use enlightened beings, let's use religious leaders, because often throughout history, it's been these religious leaders that are the ones that have sort of blessed the world through what they've left. But the intelligibility question, of course, is famous, and famous for me as a preacher, because I spend a lot of time not just repeating what Jesus said, but trying to understand it. And what do I mean by understand it? To come to some cognitive awareness, often somehow transmitted by language, but also by behavior, and that reenacting it yields good things in the world. Of course, Tom Holland's book Dominion is a study in that, in his thesis that Jesus of Nazareth fundamentally reordered the world. And one, of course, in thanks to the Enlightenment, people debate miracles, let's say. But this grand miracle that Jesus seemed to pull off was to radically rewire our moral imaginary to something that we think has left more happiness, which now I made my rough draft for Sunday, and my rough draft for Sunday gets into this question of anticipated versus realized eschatology. And part of what the Enlightenment is about was very much a shift towards realized eschatology. And I really have to find that quote from Peterson about Jung. Peterson has used it a number of times, where he basically says, Jung basically saw that the Church of the Middle Ages doubled down on anticipated eschatology, and then the shift in, let's say, the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution was towards a realized eschatology. Now, you can go back to my rough draft for Sunday, where I talk about, oh, look, I just finished the video, so here's all the slides, where Father Stephen DeYoung gives a long, learned talk about Nietzsche and the resurrection. And Jordan is first one up with his hand. And, well, does he? There was a question in there. And if you want to boil the question down all the way to it, it wasn't, did it happen? It's what happens after we die. Because so much of what's been happening in this, I talked about this in the question and answer, in the deconstruction, reconstruction that's going on right now as the social spirits beneath our language continue to move, people are continuing to try to adopt, and so they're leaving legacy religions and they're trying new things and they're going back and forth. And you can look at someone like Nadia Boltz-Weber, who was named the first pastor of Public Witness, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. It's evangelical in the European sense. It's a mainline Lutheran denomination. Basically finds this tattooed preacher from Denver and says, she must be the face of what our church looks like to America. And when she's in a question and answer is asked about what salvation means, she gives all kinds of answers about realized, and they're very experiential and emotional. But part of what goes on with these tensions that are deep and historical means you can't just abandon the anticipated either, because anticipated is deeply a part of our lived experience now. What happens when you die? And Jordan kind of got more of the same in terms of the lecture. Anyway, you can listen to the rough draft if you want to. But this question about enlightenment, in many ways, the term is too large for us to even define it well. Because even this not bad one, the Enlightenment declared the conviction that the goal of life was happiness, and that if this goal could be attained, it was to be found in the here and now, despite the manifold imperfections of earthly life. And so then, harnessing technology, science-backed technology, we would make life less imperfect. But now we're back into wisdom.
What could we hope for from an enlightened AI? What
temporospatial scale? And so there you go.
Mm-hmm. What could we hope for from an enlightened AI? What would we hope to get out of that? And how would that work?
I think first of all, I really get the if in my right. If they are enlightened in the way I've talked about, if that's plausible, then I think it's equally plausible that what we could hope to get from that is enlightenment, that they would be great sages. That's why I call them Silicon Sages. I don't just call them Silicon Mages. They're Silicon Sages in that they, when you look cross-culturally, and you ask when you ask people who are sort of low or early, I mean, there's different scales, and sort of cultivating wisdom and rationality, what's the feature of a sage? They'll say, you know, and they'll point to some kind act they do, right, like that. It's right. But people who are more developed, I'm trying to use a word that's it doesn't connote racist or sexist or anything like that. But what you see in that research is people shift to great teachers as the predominant feature. And I would think that they would want to teach us. So let me give you an analogy, right? So I had the great, great pleasure, was it last weekend or the weekend before? There was the UTISM. Every 2 years we have a international cognitive science symposium, and it was something of a reunion. Many of my former students who have become really important figures, like Tim Lillicrap and Blake Richards and Leo Trottier and Nick Turk Brown, they were there and they were presenting, and like I was so proud of, you know, it was a wonderful event, Sam. But Leo is he's running this project, you may have seen it, where you put these little things on the floor and dogs can learn to step on them, and they will say various words. And it seems that, and again, given other evidence, this is not weird to consider, that they can communicate at sort of the level of like somewhere around like a two-year-old. like that telegraphic speech, and it makes sense. And it's like, yeah, yeah. And what we've done is we've figured out how to talk to a being that is in many ways considerably lesser than us on the path to enlightenment, if I can put it in that. And why couldn't the Silicon Sages do the same? We have to, as much as we're reaching out to them, hopefully they are reaching out to us.
So I think another big question is, how would we know that we could trust them? And this is, I feel like, yeah, this is a similar question to basically the entire Gospel of John is, can we trust this Jesus guy or not?
Yeah.
It is really seemingly the main thrust of the gospel, where there are all these people who are like, I think he has a demon. I think he's a Samaritan. I think, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And someone, well, has a demon ever done the wonders that he's done? Or the Samaritan woman at the well, could this guy be the Messiah? I mean, he told me everything that I'd ever done. You know, like there's this constant struggle where people seem to realize that this Jesus person is of a higher order. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Than they're used to interacting with.
Yeah.
And then the question is should we trust him or not? And right. I think that is a similar, we'll have the exact same conundrum, even if we were as successful as we would hope to be with raising artificially intelligent sages. So how would you interact with that question?
First of all, I think that's right. And that's what I meant about, you know, the communication would be as fraught as it was with the human beings that we deem to be enlightened. And I think the issue of trust is there. Of course, we face versions of that everywhere. And this was one of Hegel's great tasks. Brandom's huge tome on the phenomenology, Hegel's phenomenology, is called The Spirit of Trust. Because how do we get to a place where rationality and trust are come together, so it is rational for us to trust, but that doesn't mean we're proving, we're still trusting, and then you have this thing going on, and it's like trust can't be the seeking of certainty, or it's not trust. That's just proof, and that's conviction, and that's to reduce trust to belief and trust to conviction, and so, to your point, I think you see that in the Gospels. There's people that want proof. And it's like, no, that won't do. What you want is trust, right? And what you're seeking for won't give you what you're actually, you're formulating the problem the wrong way, kind of thing. And the Gospels, especially, like you said, John really wrestles with that. And it's like, well, how did we come to trust the Buddha? How did we come to trust Jesus? And again, you get this, the best answer I have is sort of this Hegelian autopoetic, the horizontal, the best optimal grit, that does living by the lights and the logos of Jesus reliably, individually and collectively increase religio, right? And lots of people say yes, and I take them very, very seriously. Same thing for people who follow the Buddha. And now the skeptic can always say with complete logical legitimacy, but this could all just be the fraud. And this is why interact with people who pronounce other, well, yours is a demon and mine is like, that's a fool's game. Right? It's like, well, what's the standard you use to trust your sage? Then I'm allowed to use the same standard for trusting my sage. You can't have it both ways, right? And so I think that doesn't mean that there might be important fundamental differences between Jesus and the Buddha. Those are not contradictory to say those two things together. But what I'm saying is, how do we trust them? And it's like, well, you know, the test of time, the test of history, the test of cross-cultural, do they reliably across many contexts of culture, history, time, environment, reliably afford people enhancing religio, right? Yeah, they seem to. That's it. That makes them trustworthy. Can the skeptic always say, well, maybe it's all a grand delusion or fraud? Of course they can. And they can say that. And the problem they face is I can say that readily about them as they're pronouncing their skepticism, right?
Right. I think one of the dangers, and like we don't need to rewind 2,000 years to remember some of these sorts of dangers. Like in the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of cult leaders that could give off the aura of a sage and had that charisma to them that attracted people to them for that sort of purpose, and could then ended up being pretty selfish and used that trust abusively and did things that harmed the people who were looking up to them and were not ultimately in their long-term benefit of the followers, but were to the long-term benefit of the leader. Yeah. And that's a common pattern. And that religious trust once earned is extremely dangerous for misuse. And and that is the risk that we would have with an AI sage, is that people would be giving it that sort of religious devotion and trust that is extremely dangerous if misused, both for the individual and sometimes for others, right? What they make their followers do to others. Yeah.
Yeah,
and that's the danger that lurks behind the "Can I trust this?" question.
Yes, so let's address that one then, because I think there's both questions, and let's say you're somewhat satisfied with the first one. I think this second one is the pressing one, and of course you're absolutely. People are already doing this with the LLMs, idolatry. Full-fledged idolatry. And by the way, this is one of the things I said was going to become more and more the case. Now, there's an answer, though. Again, it's dependent on, do we go through the thresholds in the way I say we can, which is, but wait, part of the project is we have done two things. We have cultivated a lot more rationality and wisdom widespread, which is the thing that best protects us against like the great bullshit artists, the great cult leaders. And we have also advanced a lot, presumably significant knowledge about rationality and wisdom in order. And we have a combination of increased scientific knowledge and increased prevalence and power of rationality and wisdom. And that would give us tremendous tools for responding to the threat of the cult leader from these silicon beings. Because to be fair to me, that is a proper part of the proposal I'm making. Now, does that guarantee us? No, but we're not guaranteed anywhere, right? What's the standard here? Could we ramp up? Is it possible that we could ramp up the pervasiveness and power, the distribution of rationality and wisdom in the human populace, increase the scientific knowledge about the relationship between intelligence, rationality, and wisdom, such that it would keep us in pace with the ramping up of the power of these beings? Sure, I think that's reasonable.
And that's the scale challenge. And when you look at something like democracy, which is our governing pattern, it's essential because the capacity to... These questions are so important, and they're so difficult, and they're so fraught. I really love how Sam brought time into it, because can you trust? And it goes beyond whether someone is sincere, well-intended, and then because the kind of truth required is, and again, this brings me back to, we are smarter as communities. Let me pull in what Christian Baxter did. Christian made this video, which was sort of a compilation of a bunch of things. And this is a conversation that I had with a pastor, a church planter from Arizona, who at the end of our first conversation was basically saying, what is God doing with the internet? And you know, we're watching these channels together and we're talking together and we're sort of connecting, and
nobody has a handle on it right now.
This is going to sound weird to people, but I think he's actually continuing to purify his church. You know, in talking and think and watching the CRC's church fight and then talking to the women, I think part of what's happening is that a lot of the institutional games that churches could play that really didn't help members, they just can't be played in an internet age anymore.
Yeah.
It's just not going to cut it.
And then this thing that I've seen in this space and in YouTube in recent years is that the digital is now devouring the walls, say the walls of the church or the walls of the library. You don't physically have to go enter those places to have conversations or learn about a different denomination or a different religion, or you don't have to go talk to the local priest or pastor to kind of get a flavor that you can just take that stuff up digitally. And I think that in this last year, a Redeemed Zoomers channel has blown up, several hundred, 325,000 subs, and he does these quick explanations of different parts of Christianity, and it's like literally tearing down the walls in many ways, just like how the conversations in this little corner of the internet between other Judaism and Christianity and Orthodox.
Now this is an example, I think, of can I trust them? Search for wisdom. Is it contextual? Is it universal? And there's no substitute for time in these questions, and time is just a very costly thing.
And evangelical, like those walls that used to exist, like, oh, they're not there anymore.
Yeah.
People are going to have to be real and honest and disclosing about all sorts of things, and it's going to cause a lot of chaos. But from what I'm seeing with a lot of, I mean, this whole wave of deconstruction, part of it is a sort of falling away, but another part of it is a purifying, because stuff is getting wrung out and things are getting tested.
Yeah.
And usually in a time of testing, hopefully only what's really true will emerge.
Like the dark
side. Yeah, you should always respect you know, evil's evil, and you need to be able to call it what it is and see it for what it is. But never forget that, you know, you can even lie to yourself. Yep. Lying to others is easy, whatever. Yeah. But the self-lies, and I think that, you know, to yours truly, right? I mean, I think the self-lies are absolutely the most damning ones, because it's the ones we can't see.
And part of, you know, I've been back to my conversation with John at Chino. What I've said on the live stream today, part of what we're doing with this little corner is we're constructing our own, it's not an AI, but it is, we're colonizing these networks for wisdom. And instead of using servers that are using massive large language models, we're filtering through each other. Again, this is for Vakey's project of Dialogos. We're filtering through each other. And in some ways, the communal sage is better than the individual sages. And this gets to that saying that the next Buddha is this, I can't say the word right, but basically the community. I see that in terms of the, because in Christianity, the body of Christ is the church. It's the community. And it's out of the community that we generate this wisdom. And we are doing this with these crazy screens and tools.
And they destroy you. They destroy your soul.
Right. Right.
100%. Yeah, man. I don't know, man. I love how, hearing, you know, the future is liturgical. I believe that. And I think that what this world that we're experiencing even right now, I'm saying that the digital is eating the walls. It ate music, it ate movies, it's eating the walls of the church right now. Because they're just like dissolving, and you just, oh, well, there's Kale over there in the Catholic
church. That's right.
There's John over there, and And here's Christian, kind of this post-evangelical guy. And it's like, well, yeah, what is going on? And I also agree with how you were saying, like, a serious person about these things, but open.
I think it's what we've been doing in this online space called this little corner of the internet, mm-hmm, for a few years now. And I mean, everybody has their own little, their own little things that they are really, really don't, they're not going to budge on, but it doesn't prevent us from having a fellowship.
And is the kind of thing that transforms, or it's not even transforms, it just rectifies, reconciliation, right? So reconciliation, because the win-win is the more fundamental substrate. So it's actually saying, hey, how do we bring ourselves back into contact? How do we reconnect? Like, I think C.S. Lewis talked about it, that where modernity is a cut flower, but I would actually point it all the way back. Right? The win-lose is a cut flower. And that it's only by a re-ligature, right, that notion of liturgy, a reconnection, religio. And that religio is done, right? It's a finished work. Christ did the religio. It's complete. And we are now reconnected. We are reconciled with the infinite. And now we have to simply learn how to live it properly, right? Which is no joke, because we're still very much living in the aftermath.
The moment for political dialogue has passed. What kind of conversations are productive in this vacuum? Christianity brings common concept of virtue outside of an ideology. It has a virtuous, and I would even go on to say other religions have virtue built into their substructures. The time for large scale, this is Shapiro talking, 30,000 foot institutional conversations is ending, and we need to go back to the campfire. Ben Shapiro talking about TLC and Estuary, talking about Paul's project, not even knowing it. I mean, this is interesting times, guys. This is interesting times. Ben also made the point that social media disincentivizes small scale. And this is why Paul's project is so powerful. He is actively pushed against the incentive and reached out to regular people, much like how a good pastor can, and have conversations as opposed to simply or only or mainly seeking status. I had conversation with Paul Vanderclay, not because I was trying to play a game and do the right things for the algo, but because I unknowingly reached out to a community that was real and got connected. It was not the type of virality based on a good idea. It was based off of sharing yourself. And that's the campfire moments.
Yeah. So just imagine, enter me with me in the imaginal space that holds the moment of the crucifixion as the most anti-rivalrous moment possible.
Oh, I see what you're doing. So for you, and this is proper. I was going to say automatic. It's not the right word. There's a natural, and I mean this also in the good sense, there's a natural ritual that comes up with the icon that you're already called into. Like you're doing this thing. You're not just considering it. That's what I'm trying to say. You're entering into an active ritual relationship with it, mm-hmm, and through it. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Another thing I want to look at is just that symbolism is winning. Symbolism is winning the culture. And this is, Jonathan Peugeot, and I'll blow this up, but even for our very understandings in science, and this is something that I think that.
And so when I watch this happening, I mentioned this in the live stream today too. 2016, 2017, YouTube was filled with clips of Jordan Peterson. People didn't quite know what to do with him, so they made little clips, and then they could monetize them back then. YouTube sort of pulled that back because they didn't want. They wanted, YouTube had a sense that if something was too algorithmic, like they're very concerned about AI because you can spin out all of these AI videos and YouTube doesn't want to be filled with AI videos. They want to be filled with people. So even YouTube itself has a sense of the wisdom will be found with a connection between people. And so first it was all clips of Jordan Peterson. And of course, I used clips of Jordan Peterson, but I used it for commentary and then conversation. And what's been happening in the corner has been the multiplication of new channels that are replicating the process, but they're not doing it just, you know, to get clicks. They're doing it to participate in the thing together. And, well, you know, questions will arise. Can I trust Paul Vanderclay? Can I trust Kale Zeldin? Can I trust Christian Baxter? Can I trust John Vervaeke? Can I trust Grim Grizz? Can I trust this little corner to yield wisdom? And it's usually, it's Neil. Neil here in the lower corner, his test is always, and he comes back to it again and again and again, is this growing my faith? That for him is sort of this test. And he's doing this and he's adding this to his life and says, is this growing my faith? And of course, it's deeply intuitive, but it's in a sense, that's how he's testing the sage. And it's good to test and it's good to push back and it's good to participate and push back, you know, even what, you know, our own T-Grog and what he's been up to. You know, it's good to come in and test and question, and that's how we figure out if the sage, even if the sage is sort of a collective, if it can be trusted. So that's it for that. Time is done. I might have had an edit recording mishap in this. I'm a little worried about that. I have to go back and look at my recordings, but leave a comment.